some people hear music and some people see things, and I kind of see poems and I write poems.
Today, a dialogue with Ruby Mendenhall, a prolific professor and Urbana's new poet laureate. We'll listen to her verses and visit a new exhibit at a local museum focused on Black joy.
The magnificence of Black women and girls, right? Like, that's something to experience.
And later, a baseball historian is coming to town with a lot to say about the intersection of race and sports.
I may not agree with everything an athlete has to say, but I absolutely support their right to say it.
Two dialogues that may stay in your mind for a while, coming up after this news from NPR. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m., we're bringing you interviews and stories connected to Black communities in Central Illinois. This week, we're spending much of the hour with a force in Champaign-Urbana. Ruby Mendenhall touches a lot of lives at the University of Illinois. She's a family woman, she's an educator, and for the next 12 months, Mendenhall will reign as the city of Urbana's poet laureate. Today, a one-on-one dialogue with Mendenhall about her life, her work, and her words.
I am a professor here at the University of Illinois, Urbana, in sociology and African American studies, and then I'm also an associate dean at the Carroll Illinois College of Medicine. My family is here in Champaign, but we're also from Chicago. Actually, my parents migrated from the South. I always kind of put that in my introduction, my father from Alabama and my mom from Mississippi. So there's a very Southern way about me, I'd like to think.
Did you envision this life for yourself when you were growing up in Chicago?
Oh, my gosh, that's a great question. I'm thinking back to my dreams. So it's interesting. I wanted to be a physician, actually, when I was younger. And so I ended up going into occupational therapy, which I loved. I loved that job. And now I'm really, right, focusing a lot on healing, and healing is really important. So one of my professors talked about that no matter what someone wants to be, that they will do something similar to that. And like, it could be a different format than they imagined. So I guess in some ways, maybe I imagined myself as a healer.
You've conducted extensive research looking at mental and physical health of Black women. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So my research examines how gun violence affects Black mothers' mental and physical health. And so I do a lot of work on the south side of Chicago. And we interviewed actually about 100 Black women. And one of the things that was really transformative. So when I started it, I was thinking about, okay, what policies do we need to change? How do we think about changing society so that it's just and equal and that they don't have to experience this? And then one of the moms, when I was doing the interview, she waited for me and she was like, can I just say, you know, thank you for coming to see about how we're doing, to ask us how we're doing, and then what we can do together. And then she said, the little things matter and people don't understand that. And, you know, her words kept going. I kept turning them in my head. The little things matter. You know, what is she saying? And then I took it as she was saying, thank you for recognizing our humanity, that we're in conditions that we should not be in, and then thinking how we can find solutions together. So that work really was transformative. It really is has influenced all of the work that you see me do now, from the wellness store to training community health workers, their children, because the mothers often talked about how they tried to protect their children from the violence and sometimes they couldn't. Even one of the moms talked about literally putting her body over her child's body as the bullets were flying. And so that work has been very sacred. It's been beautiful also because even as they struggle, there's a lot of strength, a lot of resiliency, a lot of joy. So it was just a wonderful experience. yeah, and I'm grateful to all of them who shared their stories.
There's now the Black Joy exhibit at the Spurlock mm-hmm. Museum, and when you tour it, you see a panel of Black women in portraits, in drawings. You see families playing tennis and eating ice cream and even standing in their Sunday best. Mm-hmm. And you see artwork reflecting Black women doing yoga or dancing. And you see quilts paying homage to Black sororities. Was that part of the project that you were working on earlier? And how did that come together?
It grew out of kind of when I looked at W.E.B. Du Bois's pictures around the 1900 Paris Exposition, right? And he was showing African-Americans and how they were doing after slavery. And he was making a point about our humanity, right? Because it was still in question. And so I've always liked that and thought it was very powerful. And then also I was at a conference, I think it was in Charlotte, and I saw this exhibit of Black women, working women. They were in different uniforms. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. Like, I would love to have an exhibit around Black women. I was talking to Dr. Barbara Scott as well, and we were talking about it. So that was kind of some of the motivation behind it. And I was talking to Lakeisha Sewell, who runs Girls Like Me in Chicago. And she was like, okay, you know, I'm working with girls this summer. What do you think? And I was like, okay, love it, love it. And so she actually led a program where it was mothers and daughters. They came on Saturdays. I think it was like a month or maybe 6 weeks. And we asked them different questions, like, how do you know who you are besides what the church may say, besides what your family may say? Where do you feel most like yourself? What brings you joy? And then Florence Adebu came and she helped us to collect some of that data. So then we actually had an exhibit at the South Shore Cultural Club Center in Chicago. And then Florence wrote a grant to have it at Spurlock. And so that's how we ended up here with the exhibit.
Why is it important that people walk through?
Oh, my gosh. I think it's important that people walk through the exhibit for several reasons. One, and that I get it when I walk through, is just the beauty, the magnificence of Black women and girls, right? Like, that's something to experience. And then also, awe is good for your health, right? It creates a sense of well-being. And then also, it tells a story, right? The women talked about they feel most like themselves in nature. They feel most like themselves when they're with their family and community. And we're so excited that it's intergenerational. Everything that I try to do, I try to make it intergenerational.
Congratulations, you were named the Poet Laureate for the city of Urbana. How did you find out?
I received an email, and I was telling someone, it's funny because the email is almost like, you know, the ones that you get, well, you know, thank you, there were so many, and you're like, oh, okay. But then at the end, it was like, and you were selected. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And so I was jumping and running through the house, just super excited. So that's how I found out.
I understand that you've brought some poetry to share with us, and one of them does relate to some of your work in the Chicago area.
Yes. So I'll start with the first one, and it's part of a documentary that we're doing called What's Left Behind. So when I did, me and my team, we talked to about 100 mothers. Some of them lost their children to gun violence. And so Lisa Butler, who was working with me at the time, she's a licensed clinical social worker now, she wanted to go deeper and to talk with mothers who did lose their children to understand after the funeral, after the media kind of packs up, what's left behind. And so that's the name of the documentary. That's what we're trying to explore. I write poems a lot of times when I'm very happy or very sad. And so this poem was just me trying to process the emotions that I was feeling, listening to one of the moms and many of them who talked about kind of some of the hard parts of kind of losing their child. So the title of the poem is The Hardest Part. The hardest part was to lower you into eternity as I remain mortal, to watch you slip away from me into the forever portal. My heart torn into strips of black and blue blood as part of it went with you I cannot breathe. I cannot eat because I am your mother without you. I carried you in my womb for 9 months, protecting you through the seasons. Now, I must select the vessel to carry you beyond my reach, beyond rhyme, beyond reason. Your journey is beneath my feet, beneath this ground, and into the realm of the ancestors. So now, where do I belong in this world? My soul aches and needs to sequester.
Thank you for sharing that. How long have you been writing poetry?
Oh my gosh, I have been writing. The earliest memory I have is like when I was in second grade and the teacher put my poem on the board. And I remember kind of sitting down and having to lift my head to see like my poem, and she was talking about it. And then in fourth grade, I wrote a poem about Dr. King, and my teacher talked about that. And then when I was in 12th grade, my two English professors, Ms. Sharp and Ms. Hansberry, if they're out there, thank you. They really liked my poetry, and they had me go from room to room to read which two of the poems that I would read at AXO, the NAACP's competition. And so I chose a poem, and I didn't win, right? So I was devastated. I was sitting there crying. I was devastated. And I was like, oh, I must not be good, you know. And then there was no pathway to become a poet, right? No, so I never really thought about it, like, professionally. But I've always written. So I have hundreds and hundreds of poems. Like I said, I just, some people hear music and some people see things. And I kind of see poems and I write poems. So since second grade, and maybe sooner, maybe earlier.
As poet laureate, what are some of your plans as you go through the whole year?
Yeah, so I'm really super excited to work on a book project. And I want to do a book that's intergenerational, as I mentioned earlier. So with young people, I asked my son if he would write a poem with me. The Black Family Summit wanted me to write a poem. They were having an event to honor elders. And so I asked him, and he wrote this just like beautiful poem. And I was like, oh, how do I add to it, right? Like, this is so beautiful. But I did. So that was super exciting. And then I asked him again, and he was like, no. And I was like, okay, I guess I can't be greedy, right? I have to be grateful for the one. But then other young people that I work with, and then also seniors. I'm really interested in capturing that rhythm, that rhyme, the emotion of the different generations. So that's something I'm really looking forward to.
What is it about poetry that is so, I guess, intimate? You know, it's not like writing a long story or a novel. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes it even freaks people out. So they're like, how do I write a poem? Does it have to rhyme or whatever? But it doesn't have to.
Mm-mm. I think it's, for me especially, I think it's the emotions behind the poem, behind the even rhythm sometimes. And I think it's people trying to show you something, right? Trying to show you how they may feel about something, but without saying those words, right? I think people, poetry sometimes creates a picture. And I was saying in an earlier interview that I was on a train in New York, and I was watching this father with his daughter, and it was so beautiful. And I was trying to fit, and I was like, I was almost kind of like, oh, you know, you can't draw it, right? You don't have those skills. And I was like, okay, but wait, you're a poet, right? Like, you could write words. So I wrote to try to capture this beauty, this tenderness, that's all of that was there. So I think that's the gift, the power of poetry as all arts, right? Like, and I think it goes, and sometimes beneath the level of the intellect, right? And kind of reaches people that way.
You told the News Gazette that as an undergraduate, you wrote a paper about Toni Morrison's book, Sula. Mm. How did Miss Morrison's work inspire you?
Oh, my gosh. Toni Morrison, and I should tell you, so when I wrote that paper, my professor, and I think it was Professor Vashti Lewis, wrote back that, oh, what did she say? I don't want to misquote her, but I think something like, this is one of the best papers, or called me a scholar. I love Toni Morrison's work because it's so complicated, right? It's so complex, but it's also so vivid. And I talked about, I think, like the watery grave, and I was there, right? And I also have a vivid imagination. So I think like the two makes her work almost like kind of going to an amusement park or something for my mind. So that was the influence. And even engaging her and then having a professor like really appreciate it was also telling me something about myself, right? And I often tell young people that when someone tells you something, like really stop and listen. And because they're telling you something that they see that you may not see or understand yet, but listen and kind of take in what they're saying.
Just ahead, Ruby Mendenhall shares more poetry, paying tribute to Black Illinois women who changed history. And she talks about how to achieve wellness in a very busy, noisy world.
We talk about it as the sovereignty of Black women's quiet, or the power.
And later, sports journalist and historian Shakaya Taylor.
I think shut up and dribble and shut up and play, it's reductive. These are still humans. They participate in our society.
Dialogue continues right here on Illinois Soul.
The story of generations of people who felt the lash of bondage, the shame of servitude, the sting of segregation, but who kept on striving and hoping and doing what needed to be done so that today I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And
we real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
Those are the voices of former First Lady Michelle Obama and Gwendolyn Brooks, who won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 1950. Both Chicago women inspired a poem by Ruby Mendenhall, the new poet laureate for the city of Urbana. Welcome back to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick. For the first half of our show, we're having a dialogue with Mendenhall, a sociology and African American studies professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She is also an associate dean at the Carl Illinois College of Medicine. Inspired by Obama, Brooks, and other Black women from Illinois, Mendenhall composed this poem.
And the poem is Michelle Obama and Black Women as Alchemists. Black women alchemists have special liberation elixirs made of golden threads and ties that bind, crushing the coils of the constrictor. Frances Watkins despised slave masters' oppressive and fearful alchemy as they transformed Black babies' blood into gold coins, greed from stolen wealth, drowning out their cries of agony. She demanded, "Bury me not in a land of slaves, where mothers shriek of wild despair and stand above tiny, child-sized graves." This alchemist challenged government with pen and poems, transforming chattel slavery into mercury-red abolitionist songs. The alchemy of Ida B. Wells Barnett, lynching statistics, awakened conscience to a copper-toned human principle that these blood-orange crops of strange fruit must be resisted. Gwendolyn Brooks' children were leastwise of the land, a frustrated alchemy of mode, design, and device, platinum jewels fighting to transform inside their mother's hand. Alchemy continues with Melvina in a slave's blouse, the First Lady's great-great-grandmother with cobalt blue dreams transforming inhumane slave quarters into America's White House. She planted tomorrows full of hope and without trauma, allowing survival of generations and the acceptance of love from the future first Black president, Barack Hussein Obama. A first lady with deep brown beauty, reflecting smiling eyes, a mind trained by masterful alchemist, leaving nothing wasted, transforming Black womanhood, dancing to Maya Angelou's Still I Rise. We stood up and ran to her health and wellness call of Let's Move, hearing What's Going On and other Marvin Gaye old school grooves. When the music stopped, a hidden America emerged on ABC, her heart encased in sadness from children gone too soon, beautiful, young, lifeless bodies out of their mother's tortured reach. Michelle Obama said of children's blood that ran in the streets, Hadiya Pendleton was me and I was her. Death is warmed over too many times in this Chicago heat. She said, in this city, we are not in a zone of war yet. Our babies constantly face these hell-hot flames, even when asleep, stray bullets rock the cradle, opening death's door. She compelled the country to invest, saying, resources matter. The price is all of our humanity if we settle for failure and cannot prevent the blood of children from splattering. The First Lady's audacious alchemy is an international stage and the ears of billions, admonishing the world to end gun violence and to embrace all of our neighborhoods and every last one of our children.
Thank you for sharing. You mentioned three Black women from Chicago who had connections to Chicago, Ida B. Wells, Gwendolyn Brooks, and of course, First Lady Michelle Obama. Tell us about that.
Ida B. Wells, I think a lot about her boldness, right? Her audacity, her scientific mind, right? When she was making the case that the narrative that we had around African-Americans and lynching was false, and then her crusade, literally, right, to end it. So I'm always just amazed at that. And then also Gwendolyn Brooks, always when I read her poem, What Shall I Give My Children, right, even before I had children, right? Like, what does that mean? Someone asking, what can you give children who are seen as the least wise of the land and they're fighting to be who they are, they're right, fighting for their natural gifts to be able to flow, but they're constrained by racism and other things. And Michelle Obama and Hadiya Pendleton, right? Like kind of the relationship between those two and Hadiya just kind of representing so many children whose lives are cut short. And a lot of times people often say, oh, you know, the shooters and other things without looking at the system, right? The role of society and what it means, centuries of oppression. And how is that manifested, right? What do the symptoms of that trauma look like?
Wellness is central to Ruby Mendenhall. She is one of the curators of the Black Joy exhibit at the Spurlock Museum of World Cultures on the U of I campus. Walk inside and you're met by a wall of pictures and drawings depicting Black women on the south side of Chicago, enjoying activities with their children, gathering on the back porch, or enjoying a walk along Lake Michigan. And just a few feet away, a section called the Wellness Store, where visitors can read, meditate, play in sand, and just be still. I asked Mendenhall, what is her definition of wellness?
Great question. I think for me, the definition of wellness, my mind goes to when we train our community health workers, we talk about the Samaritan eight dimensions of wellness, mind, body, soul, community, finances, environment, right? Kind of, and I see it as a wheel. And if something is off on one part of the wheel, that then it's not kind of rolling smoothly. And I remember early in my career, like I was really focusing on wellness, and I was trying to get money from an organization, and they were like, you know, you have to come up with some pathology, right? You have to. And I was like, wow. And it was hard to do that because in my mind, I saw the wellness and how do you get there? So now I'm really on this quest of how do you create wellness tools and put them at the fingertips of individuals so that, first of all, prevention is a big part. And in this country, we don't put a lot of money and resources into prevention. I wrote this piece about the medicalization of poverty with Robin Wilson, and just the idea that we'll have people have high blood pressure, right? Like people who are unhoused and the stress and how it ravages the body versus putting them in housing and preventing all of that. And it's just, it's heartbreaking to see it. And, you know, and as an individual, you think like what role can I play in kind of dismantling that? And so that's the wellness door that you see, right? It's kind of this idea of putting those tools, what we know both from people's culture. And I tell people I'm a Black female in this country, and you see me and I'm looking like I'm fairly well. Part of that is the cultural technology that my parents, my grandparents, great-grandparents, that they've employed coming from Africa through the Middle Passage, through chattel slavery, right, through Jim Crow, through all of this. And so that part is part of the solution to the healing. And then also what we're learning from neuroscience, right, the body-mind, right, that they're very intimately connected. And then also the environment, right? So again, all of those components need to be operating at the same time. And even how can we as a society look at the complexity in that way instead of wanting to just kind of pull one or two pieces and focus on that. So I think of wellness as something that's very holistic.
How can you get wellness in this really extremely busy and noisy world?
So in the Black Joy exhibit, that picture, beautiful picture by the artist Catrice Garvin, of the Black woman with the afro, and it has the words. So that's part of when we ask the mothers, like, how do you maintain your wellness? How do you keep it together, especially those who are in neighborhoods with high levels of gun violence? And some of them talked about coming in from the neighborhood, going into their homes, and then going into the bedroom, going into the bathroom, going into the shower or the tub, and then kind of getting that sense of quiet. And so we talk about it as the sovereignty of Black women's quiet, or the power, because in that quiet, they often talked about that's where they get rejuvenated. And sometimes that quiet, they're praying, they're listening to music. So I think being able to get quiet is a really big part of it. And then also in the quiet, what's the conversation? And often that's the conversation in your head, right? And I think sometimes that's a big battle for some of us, right? Like what have we been told by society or from family or from other things? And then, of course, oppression that lingers in this society. And as I said, again, without resources to prevent a lot of the diseases, both mental and physical, I think resources are important, but I also think that there are things that people can do that can be done as we transform society.
I noticed in the exhibit that there was a lot of talk about rest, and interesting to me because the people who built this country, the enslaved people, as descendants, whenever we ask for rest or ask for a vacation or whatever, then you're accused of being lazy. Mm-hmm. How important is rest in having a discussion about that?
Oh, I think it's really critical. And even in my own life, right? Like as a Black female on campus and the service work, right, that I have done. And even I was thinking the other day, right, like, you know, if you didn't feel like you had to fight oppression, right? If you didn't feel like you had to open up doors, if you didn't feel like you had to do all these other things, what would your life look like? And it would be a lot more time for rest and relaxation and rejuvenation. And we know that's important because that's when the body is able to renew and to heal itself. So I think rest is very critical.
In the fall of 2023, Mendenhall was appointed the Catherine Lee Baines Dahlenbach Professor in Liberal Arts and Sciences, a reward for years of community outreach and scholarship. It will help her continue her wellness work, such as training high school and young adults to be community health workers. As we closed out our interview, Mendenhall read her poem, Gratitude for This Journey with You, which she also shared during her investiture ceremony.
And says, my spirit entered this world, black, brown, and beautiful. Both parents asked in different ways, what can I do for you? They loved me in a world of mahogany dowels and climbing fences. Years spent inside a double Dutch rope, learning new songs and dances. My family, amazing and complex, includes enslaved Africans fighting for survival. My Native American ancestors whisper from the trees the sacredness of my arrival. A world of poetry, movement, and music just beyond her reach. Occupational therapist, lobbyist, infant specialist, and learning how to teach. Institutions of higher learning, UIC, U of I, UM, NWU, and U of C, they have all held glorious people who saw and held me wondrously. The mothers and young people who shared their stories taught me about the world, those who have and those who have not, in a dance, often mediated by funders' pearls. To the community connected to this university and beyond, I am you and your children are mine. I see clearly the third reconstruction and renaissance that is now time to imagine and design. This honor today from the Dahlenbach family is a major milestone on my journey. To everyone in this space and time, here and now, thank you for sharing this quest with me. I stand on many, many shoulders and feel extremely grateful for each and every one of you who provided rocket fuel to my bold and audacious dreams, making many of them come true.
Ruby Mendenhall, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure. And thank you so much for your well wishes for me as Poet Laureate.
Learn more about Ruby Mendenhall and the Black Joy exhibit at the University of Illinois' Spurlock Museum of World Cultures at illinoisseoul.org. Did you know a black woman played professional baseball in the 1950s? Shakia Taylor has a lot to say about her and the intersection of race and sports.
I may not agree with everything an athlete has to say, but I absolutely support their right to say it.
A dialogue with the emerging sports historian and journalist, next from Illinois Soul. From Illinois Soul, I'm Reginald Hardwick. Here's some events around town. Writers Shakia Taylor and Lewis Moore discuss the intersection of race, sports, and politics at the Sporting Publics Symposium, March 28th and 29th on the U of I campus. The Rare Book and Manuscript Library will be at the Champaign Main Library to discuss blackout poetry and the Gwendolyn Brooks Poetry Collection on April 10th. But you have to register for the event starting April 1st. If you know of something going on around town, send us an email at illinois-soul@illinois.edu. You're listening to Illinois Soul on FM 101.1 and FM 90.9 HD2 Urbana. Listening to Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine focused on the Black communities of Central Illinois. I'm Reginald Hardwick. On March 28th and 29th, the Humanities Research Institute at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign will host a symposium called Sporting Publics. You are invited to learn how athletes can help us shine a light on problems in our society. One of the speakers is Shakia Taylor, a senior editor and writer at the Chicago Tribune, where her work examines the intersection of sports and culture. She's also a baseball historian with a specialty on women and African Americans in the game. Taylor spoke with my colleague Brian Mackey of the 21st Show. In a moment, you'll hear her take on Black athletes who have spoken out about injustices and the Black woman who made history in baseball. But first, Taylor explains hair dynamics in video games.
I learned about this very recently myself. And hair dynamics are the way the hair looks in the game, the way it looks, the way it moves, the way it flows, the texture, the details. Had no idea that even went into video games.
Yeah. Is it a helmet or does it actually flow? Why is this important, right? Why were they introduced to the big baseball game this year?
Hair dynamics were introduced into this year's edition of MLB The Show, with Tony Stone being added to the game as part of the Negro League storyline season 2. She is the first woman to play in a men's pro league and now the first woman to play in a men's pro league baseball game.
Yeah, what can you tell her about us? You recently wrote about her in the Tribune and through her appearance in this video game.
Oh, yeah. So like I said, Tony was the first woman to play in a men's pro league. She played for the Indianapolis Clowns in 1953. She replaced someone many of us know, Hank Aaron, as he is known, as their second baseman. She had to kind of figure it out on her own as the first woman and only woman at that time to play. She ended up only playing 2 seasons in the Negro American League, but they were 2 pretty good seasons. The Tribune said that she was valuable to her team, which is not something I expected to hear, because you hear so much that she was more of a novelty, you know, just getting people to come see a girl play, so to speak. So she was a tremendous woman who is more of an unknown pioneer, one of those footnotes in baseball history who's starting to get some real serious attention now.
Yeah, what are the value, do you think, of the storylines feature in this video game, for example, and bringing these stories to a wider audience?
First, I think there's tremendous value in putting something historical like this in a video game. You always hear from people that they think their kids or, you know, other adults waste time playing video games. And it's such, you know, it's not this, you're not learning from it. It's not educational. What skills are you picking up? But something like this goes against that. It's inserted into a game. It's documentary style, but you're playing. And so I think with the way Negro League's history has been sort of buried over time, in kind of a way, in that so few people know about it, those who do hold on to it and just really want to share it, this brings it in a new way to an entirely new generation. And to a certain degree, not a new generation. There are some older people who play video games who aren't aware of this. So I think it's just bringing another part of baseball history to light. And this is American history, so it's for all of us. And I think that's a tremendous move by both Sony and MLB, well, I should say, and, you know, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, where Bob Kendrick is doing a tremendous job in making that history accessible.
You've talked many times about growing up as a baseball fan in Ohio when the Cleveland Guardians, then known as the Indians, were a strong team. Were you always interested, though, in the history side of baseball?
I've always been interested in history generally. I can't really pinpoint a moment, but I've always been a question asker. My dad told me a story recently about we were on a road trip that was about 4 hours long and I would not stop talking. And I was probably about 11 or 12 years old at that time. And it's because I'm curious. I think that's the root of everything I write is I always want to know how. I want to know the nuts and bolts. I want to know, you know, who had the idea first? What inspired the idea? What were you doing when you got the idea? What was happening around you when you got the idea? I think history is so important that it's just been an interest of mine in every way. And I think in sport, it's even more important simply because it makes it fun. It gives an interesting angle. We learn about pioneers. We make connections to real life that maybe we didn't realize were there. History is always happening around us. So my interest started really young and sport is just where it blossomed.
I want to go back to Toni Stone, who we were just talking about a minute ago. You, in your piece, you have a screen grab, I guess, like a clip from the 1953 Chicago Daily Tribune. The headline was, "Girl to Play for Clowns Today." Okay, that sounds incredibly sexist to modern ears. I'm guessing you could find a dozen other equally or more sexist things in a newspaper of that era, probably racist, too. I wonder what it's like for you steeping yourself in this history.
You know, sometimes I read things like that, and that headline is a wonderful example because I wonder if it was meant to sound that way, right? I wonder if we're just reading it in present day ears or with present day understanding. Because if you look, you know, deeper into the piece, they praise her. They say positive things about her. And a big part of me as a Black woman digging into these types of things in history is I have to sort of remove myself from the story, right? Like I can look at it with my own experience or with my own informed perspective, but I try not to take it personally. I try to keep everything in its time. I really thought it was cool, first of all, that she had a mention in the Tribune in 1953.
Yeah.
Huge. Because so much of Black baseball history wasn't in major newspapers. It wasn't in mainstream news. You find it more in smaller regional newspapers, in the Black press, and a lot of those places no longer exist.
Well, this actually dovetails nicely with something else I wanted to ask you about, which is your work with the Society for American Baseball Research's Negro Leagues and Teams Committee. This is ongoing work to decide which leagues from the segregated era of baseball should be considered major leagues. I guess, first off, why is that important?
The research itself is important in that so many things that happened in the past are sort of being disregarded. And I think the Negro Leagues is an example of that. If we don't work to preserve that history, if we don't work to kind of shove it forward, to kind of put it in the eyes of those who need to see it, it disappears. We can't just hold it in our memory. But I also think it's righting some wrongs there. I think this idea that Major League Baseball was the only professional baseball league that matters, it's something that needed to be addressed. I'm not sure how I feel entirely about the thing that took it out also being the thing that tries to bring it back. But I think it's very important work from a research side. I think it's very important work from a history side. I think that the people who are involved, because there's more than, like, there's this larger committee and then it's broken down into multiple groups, right? So there's a lot of thought and time and effort and math being put into what this all means and where it should be. And I don't like to use the term elevate, but in a sense, it does elevate it if you think of it, and it's just bringing it forward. It's showing the talent that existed in these leagues. It's showing this wasn't a lesser type of baseball. This was just baseball. When you talk to people who lived during the times of the Negro Leagues, because this wasn't that long ago, when we talk about it, it comes up as if this happened hundreds of years ago. Sure, the beginning of it was hundreds of years ago, but not the end. We're talking about Tony Stone playing in 1953. So that wasn't that long ago. Many of us have family members who were kids or adults at that time. So this is very recent history that we're trying to help bring forward for a new generation, that we're trying to connect some dots for people. You hear about Jackie Robinson reintegrating Major League Baseball, but it's like things happened before that. There was Black baseball before that. So I think this kind of just brings all of that forward.
There is a long history of athletes using their celebrity to call attention to issues in society, right? From Tommy Smith and John Carlos to Colin Kaepernick. You do often hear, I did want to ask you, you hear this strain among some pundits in sports and politics who say, you know, shut up and play, shut up and dribble, whatever it is. I wonder what you think of that, given your knowledge of the history of protest in sports and the work that people had to put in over many years.
I think people say shut up and play or shut up and dribble only when they disagree. Because when someone says something they agree with, obviously they want them to say it more, right? So I may not agree with everything an athlete has to say, but I absolutely support their right to say it. And so I think shut up and dribble and shut up and play, it's reductive. These are still humans. They participate in our society in many ways, right? They vote. They drive our roads. They have children who go to school. So things that impact regular people also impact them in a lot of ways. And I also think that if you have a platform of any kind and you want to use it to express how you feel about humanity or how you feel about certain issues, that is absolutely something you should be able to do. But I do want to say that, having the right to say something does not mean that you can say it without consequence or without someone saying, something in return. But I am fully behind athletes participating in society. That is what protest is. That is what speaking out is. It is participating in society.
That was Shakia Taylor. She is a senior editor and writer at the Chicago Tribune, where her work examines the intersection of sports and culture. She'll speak at the U of I's Humanities Research Institute Symposium called Sporting Publics. It takes place March 28th and 29th, and we have information at IllinoisSoul.org. And that's this week's dialogue. Tell us what you think about Ruby Mendenhall's poetry, the Black Joy exhibit at Spurlock Museum, or Black Athletes. Leave us a voicemail at 217-244-1989. Again, 217-244-1989. Dialogue airs Saturdays at 11 a.m. and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL FM 90.9 HD2. As well as WILL AM 580 on Wednesday nights at 8. Lamont Holden composed our theme. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are brought to you by Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll have a dialogue with you again next week.